fists in the air. Then he saw policemen coming toward him, half a dozen at least. They wore white shirts and bullet belts and colossal holsters with pistol handles showing. In fact, they were court officers. They closed in around him. "They're putting me back in the cell." Then he realized they were forming a flying wedge to get him through the crowd. So many glowering faces, black and white. "Murderer, motherfucker, you gonna get what Henry Lamb got. Say your prayers, Park Avenue. Tell you a new one." "McCoy say? McDead, baby." He stumbled on, between his white-shirted protectors. He could hear them groaning and straining as they pushed back the crowd. "Coming through, coming through." Here and there other faces popped up, lips moving. The tall Englishman with the blonde hair, fellow, the press. Then more shouts. "You mine, needle nose, mine. Count every breath, baby. Get him! Lights out, sucker. Look at him, Park Avenue." Even in the midst of the storm, Sherman felt strangely unmoved by what was happening. His thoughts told him it was something dreadful, but he didn't feel it. "Since I'm already dead." The storm burst out of the courtroom and into a lobby. The lobby was full of people standing about. Sherman could see their expressions change from consternation to fear. They began scurrying to the sides to make way for the rogue galaxy of bodies that had just burst out of the courtroom. Now Killian and the court officers were steering him onto an escalator. There was a hideous mural on the wall. The escalator was heading down. Pressure from behind. He pitched forward, landing on the back of a court officer on the step below. For a moment it seemed as if an avalanche of bodies. But the court officer caught himself on the rolling railings. Now the screaming galaxy burst through the front doors and out onto the main stairway on 161st Street. A wall of bodies was in the way. Television cameras, 6 or 8 of them, microphones, 15 or 20 of them, screaming people, the press. The two masses of humanity met, merged, froze. Killian rose up in front of Sherman. Microphones were in his face, and Killian was declaiming most oratorically.
"I want you to show the whole city of New York what you saw in there."
With the most curious detachment, Sherman found himself aware of every street inflection of the fop's voice.
"You saw a circus arrest, and then you saw a circus arraignment, and then you saw the district attorney's office prostituting itself and perverting the law for your cameras and for the approval of a partisan mob. Boo! Yeah! Partisan you, you bent-nosed bastard!"
Somewhere behind him, no more than 24 inches away, someone was keening in a sing-song falsetto.
"Say your prayers, McCoy. Your day is done. Say your prayers, McCoy. Your day is done."
Killian said, "We reached an agreement with the district attorney yesterday."
The sing-song falsetto said,
"Say your prayers, McCoy. Count your breaths."
Sherman looked up at the sky. The rain had stopped. The sun had broken through. It was a lovely, balmy day in June. There was a fluffy blue dome over the Bronx. He looked at the sky and listened to the sounds, just the sounds. The orotund tropes and sententiae, the falsetto songs, the inquisitory shouts, the hippo mutterings, and he thought, "I'm not going back in there, ever. I don't care what it takes to keep me out, even if I have to stick a shotgun in my mouth." The only shotgun he had was, in fact, double-barreled. It was a big old thing. He stood on 161st Street, a block from the Grand Concourse in the Bronx, and wondered if he could get both barrels in his mouth. Chapter 23. Inside the Cavity.
"Well, there you are, Larry," said Abe Weiss with a big grin. "They sure gave you a shiny dome."
Since Weiss was now inviting him to do it, Kramer did what he had been wanting to do for the past 45 seconds, which was to turn completely away from Weiss and look at the bank of television sets on the wall. And there, indeed, he was. The videocassette had just reached the part in the Channel 1 broadcast from last night, in which the artist's drawing showed the scene in the courtroom. The sound was on low, but Kramer could hear the voice of the announcer, Robert Corso, as if he were right inside his skull.
Assistant District Attorney Lawrence Kramer thrust the petition towards Judge Samuel Auerbach and said, "Your Honor, the people of the Bronx."
In the drawing, the top of his head was absolutely bald, which was unrealistic and unfair because he was not bald, he was only balding. Nevertheless, there he was. It was not one of those people we see on TV, it was himself. And if there was ever a powerful warrior for justice, it was himself on that screen. His neck, his shoulders, his chest, his arms, they were huge, as if he were heaving the 16-pound shot in the Olympics instead of waving a few pieces of paper at Sammy Auerbach. True, one reason he looked so big was that the drawing was a little out of proportion, but that was probably the way the artist had seen him, larger than life. The artist, what a juicy Italian girl she had been, lips like nectarines. Nice breasts underneath a shiny, silky jersey. Lucy Della Floria, her name was. If there hadn't been such commotion and confusion, it would have been the easiest thing in the world. After all, she had sat there in the courtroom concentrating on him at center stage, absorbed in the look of him, in the passion of his presentation, the confidence of his performance on the field of battle. She had been absorbed as an artist and as a woman, with full Italian dirty girl lips, in himself. All too soon, just like that, the drawing was gone, and Weiss was on the screen, with a whole forest of microphones sticking up at him. The microphones had been on little metal stands on his desk for the press conference he gave right after the arraignment. He had given another one this morning. Weiss knew exactly how to keep the focus on himself. Oh, yes. The average TV watcher would assume that the show was all Abe Weiss's, and that the assistant district attorney who presented the case in the courtroom, this Larry Kramer, was merely the instrument of Abe Weiss's gravel-voiced strategic brilliance. Weiss hadn't actually worked on his feet in a courtroom the whole time he had been in office, which was almost 4 years. But Kramer didn't resent that, or not very much. That was the given. That was the way it worked. It was thus in every district attorney's office, not just Weiss's. No, on this particular morning, Captain Ahab was okay with Kramer. The TV news and the newspapers had featured the name Lawrence Kramer many times, and she, luscious Lucy Della Floria, sexy Lucy Delicate Flower, had done his portrait and captured the mighty Kramer form. Nah, it was fine. And Weiss had just gone to the trouble of pointing that out to him by playing the video cassette. The implicit message was,
"All right, I make myself the star because I run this office, and I am the one who has to face re-election, but see, I don't leave you out. You get the second billing."
So the two of them watched the rest of the Channel 1 coverage on the television set on the paneled wall. There was Thomas Killian, standing outside the criminal courts building with the microphones held up at his face.
"Look at those fucking clothes," muttered Weiss. "Looks fucking ridiculous."
What crossed Kramer's mind was how much such clothes must cost. Killian was going on about how this was a circus arrest and a circus arraignment. He appeared to be extremely angry.
"We reached an agreement with the district attorney yesterday that Mr. McCoy would present himself for arraignment here in the Bronx peacefully, voluntarily this morning, and the district attorney chose to violate that agreement and bring Mr. McCoy in like a violent felon, like an animal. And for what? For your cameras and for votes."
"Get out of here," White said to the screen.
Killian was saying,
"Mr. McCoy not only denies these charges, but he is eager for the facts in his case to come out. And when they come out, you will see that the scenario that is being contrived for this case is utterly without foundation."
"Blah, blah, blah," Weiss said to the screen.
The camera moved to a figure standing just behind Killian. It was McCoy. His tie was loose and pulled to one side. His shirt and jacket were rumpled. His hair was matted. He looked half-drowned. His eyes rolled up toward the sky. He didn't look all there. Now Robert Corso's face was on the screen, and he was talking about McCoy, McCoy, McCoy. It was no longer the Lamb case. It was the McCoy case. The big Wall Street wasp with the aristocratic profile had given the case some sex appeal. The press couldn't get enough of it. Weiss's desk was covered with newspapers. He still had yesterday afternoon's City Light right up on top. In enormous letters, the front page said, "Wall Street socialite nabbed in hit and run." The words were banked up against a tall, narrow picture of McCoy, soaking wet, with his hands in front of him and his suit jacket folded over his hands, obviously to hide his handcuffs. He had his big, handsome chin up, and a ferocious scowl beamed straight down his nose at the camera. He looked as if he was saying, "Yeah, and what of it?" Even the Times had the case on the front page this morning, but it was the City Light that was really going wild. The headline this morning said, "Seek Foxy Brunette Mystery Girl." A smaller headline up above said, "Team Mercedes, he hit, she ran." The picture was the one from the social magazine W, the one Roland Auburn had pointed to, the one of McCoy in his tuxedo, grinning, and of his wife, looking proper and plain. The caption said, "Eyewitness called McCoy's companion younger, more foxy. A hotter ticket than his 40-year-old wife Judy, shown here with hubby at charity bash." A line of white letters on a black bar at the bottom of the page said, "Protesters demand jail, not bail, for Wall Street whiz, see page 3, and Shay McCoy and Shay Lamb, a tale of two cities, pictures page 4 and 5. On pages 4 and 5 were pictures of McCoy's Park Avenue spread, the ones from Architectural Digest on one side, and pictures of the Lamb's tiny rooms in the project on the other. A long caption began, "Two vastly different New Yorks collided when Wall Street investment banker Sherman McCoy's $50,000 Mercedes-Benz sports roadster struck honor student Henry Lamb. McCoy lives in a $3 million 14-room two-story apartment on Park Avenue. Lamb in a $247 a month three-room apartment in a housing project in the South Bronx." Weiss loved every square inch of the coverage. It had blown all this talk of white justice and Johannes Bronx right out of the tub. They hadn't managed to jack McCoy's bail up to $250,000, but they had gone after that aggressively. Aggressively, Kramer smiled. Sammy Arbach's eyes had opened up like a pair of umbrellas when he had waved the petition at him. That had been just a shade outrageous, but it had gotten the point across. The Bronx DA's office was in touch with the people, and they would keep petitioning for higher bail. No. Weiss was pleased. That was obvious. This was the first time Kramer had ever been summoned into Weiss's office by himself, without Bernie Fitzgibbon. Weiss pressed a button, and the television set went blank. He said to Kramer,
"Did you see the way McCoy looked standing there? He looked like a fucking mess. Milt said that's the way he looked when he came in the courtroom yesterday. He said he looked like hell. What was that all about?"
"Well," said Kramer, "all it was, it was raining. He got wet while he was standing in line outside a central booking. They made him wait in line like everybody else, which was the whole point, not to give him special treatment."
"All right," said Weiss. "But for Christ's sake, here we're bringing Park Avenue into the courtroom, and Milt says the guy looked like he was just fished out of the river. Bernie was giving me a hard time about that, too. He didn't want to take him through central booking in the first place."
"He didn't look all that bad, Mr. Weiss," said Kramer.
"Make it Abe."
Kramer nodded, but decided he would wait a decent interval before trying out his first Abe. "He didn't look any different from anybody else who comes in from out of the pens.
And there's Tommy Killian trying to raise a big stink about it, too."
He gestured toward the television sets. Kramer thought, "Well, you finally stood up on your hind legs against the two donkeys. Bernie had been unhappy, to put it mildly, when Weiss overruled him and ordered Kramer to request that McCoy's bail be raised from $10,000 to $250,000 after Bernie had struck a deal at $10,000 with Killian. Weiss told Bernie it was only to placate the angry residents of the community, who thought McCoy would get special treatment, and that he knew Auerbach wouldn't actually set such a high bail. But to Bernie, it was a breach of contract, a violation of favor bank regulations, of the sacred code of loyalty of one harp to another in the criminal justice system. Kramer could see a cloud passing in front of Weiss's face, and then Weiss said,
"Well, let Tommy squawk. You can drive yourself crazy if you try to please everybody. I had to make a decision, and I made a decision. Bernie likes Tommy, and that's okay. I like Tommy myself. But Bernie wants to give him the goddamn store. The promises he made Tommy, McCoy was gonna come traipsing through here like Prince Charles. How long was McCoy in the pens?"
"Oh, about 4 hours."
"Well, hell, that's about normal, isn't it?"
"About. I've seen defendants get shuffled from one precinct lockup to another, and then to central booking, and then to Rikers Island, and then back to central booking, and then they get arraigned. They get arrested on a Friday evening, they can spend the whole weekend bouncing around. Then you're looking at somebody who's a mess. McCoy didn't even have to start off in a precinct house and get bussed over to central booking."
"Well then, I don't know what all this goddamn belly aching is. Did anything happen to him in the pens? What's the big deal?"
"Nothing happened. The computer went down, I think, so there was a delay, but that happens all the time too, that's normal."
"You want to know what I think? I think Bernie, without knowing it, don't get me wrong, I like Bernie and I respect Bernie, but I think, without knowing it, he really does think someone like McCoy should get special treatment because he's white and because he's well known. Now, this is a subtle thing. Bernie's Irish, just like Tommy's Irish, and the Irish have a certain amount of what the English call deference built into them, and they don't even know it. They're impressed by these waspy guys like McCoy, even though consciously they may act and think like they're members of the IRA. It's not really important, but a guy like Bernie's got this deference thing to deal with, this unconscious Irish thing, and he doesn't even know about it. But we don't represent the WASPs, Larry. I wonder if there's even a WASP living in the Bronx. There must be one in Riverdale somewhere." Kramer chuckled. "No, I'm serious," said Weiss. "This is the Bronx. This is the laboratory of human relations. That's what I call it, the laboratory of human relations."
That was true. He called it the laboratory of human relations. He called it that every day, as if oblivious of the fact that everyone who had ever been in his office had heard him say it before. But Kramer was in the mood to forgive Weiss's fatuous side. More than forgive, to understand and appreciate the essential truth that underlay his buffoon's way of putting things. Weiss was right. You couldn't run the criminal justice system in the Bronx and pretend you were in some kind of displaced Manhattan.
"Come here," said Weiss.
He got up from his great chair and walked over to the window behind him and beckoned to Kramer. From up here on the sixth floor, at the top of the hill, the view was grand. They were up high enough so that all sordid details receded, and the Bronx's lovely rolling topology took over. They looked out over Yankee Stadium and John Mullaly Park, which from up here actually looked green and sylvan. In the distance, straight ahead across the Harlem River, was the skyline of Upper Manhattan, up where Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center was. And from here it looked pastoral, like one of those old landscape paintings in which they put some fuzzy trees in the background and some soft gray clouds. Weiss said,
"Look down there on those streets, Larry. What do you see? Who do you see?"
All that Kramer could see, in fact, were some tiny figures walking along 161st Street and Walton Avenue. They were so far below they were like insects.
"They're all black and Puerto Rican," said Weiss. "You don't even see any old Jews walking around down there anymore, or any Italians either. And this is the civic center of the Bronx. This is like Montague Street in Brooklyn or City Hall Plaza in Manhattan. In the summertime, the Jews used to sit out on the sidewalk at night right over there in the Grand Concourse and just watch the cars go by.
You couldn't get Charles Bronson to sit out there now. This is the modern era, and nobody understands it yet. When I was a kid, the Irish ran the Bronx. They ran it for a long time. You remember Charlie Buckley? Charlie Buckley, the congressman? No, you're too young. Charlie Buckley, the boss of the Bronx. As Irish as they come. Up to about 30 years ago, Charlie Buckley was still running the Bronx, and now they're finished. And so who runs it? Jews and Italians. But for how long? There's none down there on the street. And so how long are they going to be up here in this building? But that's the Bronx, the laboratory of human relations. That's what I call it, the laboratory of human relations. Those are poor people you're looking at down there, Larry, and poverty breeds crime. And the crime in this borough, well, I don't have to tell you. Part of me's an idealist. I want to deal with every case on an individual basis and every person one by one. But with the caseload we got, hey! The other part of me knows that what we're really doing, we're like a little band of cowboys running a herd. With a herd, the best you can hope for is to keep the herd as a whole. He made a great round gesture with his hands. Under control, and hope you don't lose too many along the way. Oh, the day will come, and maybe pretty soon, when those people down there will have their own leaders and their own organizations, and they'll be the Bronx Democratic Party and everything else, and we won't be in this building any longer. But right now they need us, and we have to do the right thing by them. We have to let them know that we're not removed from them, and that they're just as much a part of New York as we are. We have to send them the right signals. We have to let them know that maybe we come down hard on them when they get out of line, but it's not because they're black or Hispanic or poor. We gotta let them know justice really is blind. We gotta let them know if you're white and rich, it works out the same way. That's a very important signal. It's more important than any specific point or technicality of the law. That is what this office is all about, Larry. We're not here to handle cases. We're here to create hope. That's what Bernie doesn't understand. The doesn't, in preference to the Irish don't, signaled the elevation of the DA's thoughts at this moment. Bernie is still playing Irish politics, said Weiss. The same way Charlie Buckley used to play it, and that's finished. It's all over. This is the modern era in the laboratory of human relations, and we have a sworn duty to represent those people you're looking at down there. Kramer peered down diligently at the insects. As for Weiss, the loftiness of his sentiments had filled his voice and his face with emotion. He gave Kramer a sincere look and a tired smile, the sort of look that says, "That's what life is all about, once the petty considerations have been swept away." "I never thought about it that way before, Abe," said Kramer. "But you're absolutely right." It seemed like a good moment for the first Abe. "I was worried about this McCoy case at the beginning," said Weiss. "It looked like Bacon and those people were forcing the issue and all we were doing was reacting. But that's okay. It turned out to be a good thing. How do we treat some hotshot from Park Avenue? Like anybody else, that's how. He gets arrested, he gets the cuffs, he gets booked. He gets fingerprinted, he waits in the pens, just like anybody down there in those streets. Now, I think that sends a hell of a good signal. It lets those people know we represent them and they're a part of New York City." Weiss gazed down upon 161st Street like a shepherd upon his flock. Kramer was glad no one but himself was witnessing this. If more than one witness had been on hand, then cynicism would have reigned. You wouldn't have been able to think about anything other than the fact that Abe Weiss had an election coming up in 5 months and 70% of the inhabitants of the Bronx were black and Latin. But since there was, in fact, no other witness, Kramer could get to the heart of the matter, which was that the manic creature before him, Captain Ahab, was right. "You did a great job yesterday, Larry," said Weiss, "and I want you to keep pouring it on.
Doesn't it make you feel good to use your talents for something that means something? Christ, you know what I make?
That Kramer did. It was $82,000 a year.
A dozen times I could have taken a fork in the road and gone out and made three times, five times that in private practice. And for what?
You only pass this way once, Larry. What do you want to be remembered for? That you had a fucking mansion in Riverdale or Greenwich or Locust Valley? Or that you made a difference?
I feel sorry for Tommy Killian. He was a good assistant DA, but Tommy wanted to make some money. And so now he's out making some money. But how? He's holding the hands and wiping the noses of a bunch of wise guys, psychotics and dopers. A guy like McCoy makes him look good. He hasn't seen a guy like that in all the years he's been out of here. No. I'd rather run the laboratory of human relations. That's the way I think of it. I'd rather make a difference.
You did a great job yesterday, and I want you to keep pouring it on.
Christ, I wonder what time it is, said Weiss. I'm getting hungry.
Kramer looked at his watch with alacrity.
Almost 12:15.
Why don't you stick around and have lunch? Judge Tonetto's coming by, and this guy from the Times, Overton something or other. I always forget. They're all named Overton or Clifton or some fucking name like that. And Bobby Vitello and Lou Weintraub. You know Lou Weintraub? No? Stick around. You'll learn something.
Well, if you're sure.
Of course.
Weiss motioned toward his gigantic conference table, as if to say there's plenty of room.
Just ordering in some sandwiches.
He said this as if this happened to be one of those spur-of-the-moment lunches where you order in instead of going out, as if he or any other shepherd from the island fortress dared stroll out amid the flock and have lunch in the civic center of the Bronx. But Kramer banished all cheap cynicism from his thoughts. Lunch with the likes of Judge Tonetto, Bobby Vitello, Lou Weintraub, the real estate developer, Overton whichever wasp of the New York Times, and the district attorney himself. He was emerging from the anonymous ooze. Thank God for the great white defendant. Thank you, God, for Mr. Sherman McCoy. With a blink of curiosity, he wondered about McCoy. McCoy wasn't much older than he was. How did this little icy dip into the real world feel to a wasp who had had everything just the way he wanted it all his life? But it was only that, a blink. The Bororo Indians, a primitive tribe who live along the Vermelho River in the Amazon jungles of Brazil, believe that there is no such thing as a private self. The Bororos regard the mind as an open cavity, like a cave or a tunnel or an arcade, if you will, in which the entire village dwells and the jungle grows. In 1969, José M. R. Delgado, the eminent Spanish brain physiologist, pronounced the Bororos correct. For nearly three millennia, Western philosophers had viewed the self as something unique, something encased inside each person's skull, so to speak. This inner self had to deal with and learn from the outside world, of course, and it might prove incompetent in doing so. Nevertheless, at the core of oneself, there was presumed to be something irreducible and inviolate. Not so, said Delgado. Each person is a transitory composite of materials borrowed from the environment. The important word was transitory, and he was talking not about years, but about hours. He cited experiments in which healthy college students lying on beds in well-lit but soundproof chambers, wearing gloves to reduce the sense of touch and translucent goggles to block out specific sights, began to hallucinate within hours. Without the entire village, the whole jungle, occupying the cavity, they had no minds left. He cited no investigations of the opposite case, however. He did not discuss what happens when oneself,
or what one takes to be oneself, is not a mere cavity open to the outside world, but has suddenly become an amusement park to which everybody, todo el mundo, tout le monde, comes scampering, skipping, and screaming, nerves a-tingle, loins aflame, ready for anything, all you've got, laughs, tears, moans, giddy thrills, gasps, horrors, whatever, the gorier the merrier. Which is to say, he told us nothing of the mind of a person at the center of a scandal in the last quarter of the 20th century. At first, in the weeks following the incident in the Bronx, Sherman McCoy had regarded the press as an enemy that was stalking him out there. He feared each day's newspapers and news broadcasts, the way a man would fear the weapons of any impersonal and unseen enemy, the way he would fear falling bombs or incoming shells. Even yesterday, outside the central booking facility, in the rain and the filth, when he saw the whites of their eyes and the yellow of their teeth, and they reviled and taunted and baited him, when they did everything short of trampling and spitting upon him, they were still the enemy out there. They had closed in for the kill, and they hurt him and humiliated him. But they could not reach his inviolable self. Sherman McCoy, inside the brass crucible of his mind. They closed in for the kill, and then they killed him. He couldn't remember whether he had died while he was still standing in line outside, before the door to central booking opened, or while he was in the pens. But by the time he left the building and Killian held his impromptu press conference on the steps, he had died and been reborn. In his new incarnation, the press was no longer an enemy, and it was no longer out there. The press was now a condition, like lupus erythematosus or Wegener's granulomatosis. His entire central nervous system was now wired into the vast, incalculable circuit of radio and television and newspapers, and his body surged and burned and hummed with the energy of the press and the prurience of those it reached, which was everyone, from the closest neighbor to the most bored and distant outlander titillated for the moment by his disgrace. By the thousands, no, the millions, they now came scampering into the cavity of what he had presumed to be his self, Sherman McCoy. He could no more keep them from entering his very own hide than he could keep the air out of his lungs. Or, better said, he could keep them out only in the same manner that he could deny air to his lungs once and for all. That solution occurred to him more than once during that long day, but he fought against morbidity. He did. He who had already died once. It started within minutes after he and Killian managed to disengage themselves from the mob of demonstrators and reporters and photographers and camera crews and get into the car service sedan Killian had hired. The driver was listening to an easy listening station on the car radio, but in no time the every half-hour news broadcast came on, and right away Sherman heard his name. His name, and all the key words that he would hear and see over and over for the rest of the day. Wall Street, socialite, hit and run, Bronx honor student, unidentified female companion. And he could see the driver's eyes in the rearview mirror, staring into the open cavity known as Sherman McCoy. By the time they reached Killian's office, the midday edition of the City Light was already there, and his contorted face was staring back at him from the front page. And everyone in New York was free to walk right in through those horrified eyes of his. Late in the afternoon, when he went home to Park Avenue, he had to run a gauntlet of reporters and television camera crews to get into his own apartment building. They called him Sherman, as merrily and contemptuously and imperiously as they pleased. And Eddie, the doorman, looked into his eyes and stuck his head way down into the cavity. To make matters worse, he had to ride up on the elevator with the Morrisseys, who lived in the penthouse apartment. They said nothing. They just poked their long noses inside the cavity and sniffed at his shame, until their faces stiffened from the stench. He had counted on his unlisted telephone number as a retreat, But the press had already solved that by the time he got home, and Bonita, kind Bonita, who took only a quick peek inside the cavity, had to screen the calls. Every imaginable news organization called, and there were a few calls for Judy. And for himself? Who would be so deficient in dignity, so immune to embarrassment, as to make a personal telephone call to this great howling public arcade, this shell of shame and funk, which was Sherman McCoy himself? Only his mother and father, and Raleigh Thorpe. Well, at least Raleigh had that much in him. Judy, roaming the apartment, shocked and distant. Campbell, bewildered, but not in tears, not yet. He hadn't thought he would be able to face the television screen, and yet he turned it on. The vilification poured forth from every channel. Prominent Wall Street investment banker, top echelon at Pearson Pierce, socialite, prep school, Yale, spoiled son of the former general partner of Dunning, Spungen & Leach, the Wall Street law firm, in his $60,000 Mercedes sports roadster, now an extra $10,000, with a foxy brunette who is not his wife and not anything like his wife, and who makes his wife look dowdy by comparison, runs over an exemplary son of the deserving poor, a young honor student who grew up in the housing projects, and flees in his fancy car without so much as a moment's pity, let alone help for his victim, who now lies near death. The eerie thing was, and it felt eerie, as he had sat there looking at the television set, was that he was not shocked and angered by these gross distortions and manifest untruths. Instead, he was shamed. By nightfall, they had been repeated so often on the vast circuit to which his very hide now seemed wired, that they had taken on the weight of truth, in that millions had now seen this Sherman McCoy on the screen, and they knew him to be the man who had committed the heartless act. They were here now, in vast mobs, clucking and fuming and probably contemplating worse than that, inside the public arcade that he had once thought to be the private self of Sherman McCoy. Everyone, every living soul who gazed upon him, with the possible exception of Maria, if she ever gazed upon him again, would know him as this person on the front of 2 million, 3 million, 4 million newspapers, and on the screen of God knew how many million television sets. The energy of their accusations, borne over the vast circuit of the press, which was wired into his central nervous system, hummed and burned through his hide and made his adrenaline pump. His pulse was constantly fast, and yet he was no longer in a state of panic. A sad, sad torpor had set in. He could concentrate on nothing, not even long enough to feel sad about it. He thought of what this must be doing to Campbell and to Judy, and yet he no longer felt the terrible pangs he felt before he died. This alarmed him. He looked at his daughter and tried to feel the pangs, but it was an intellectual exercise. It was all so sad and heavy, heavy, heavy. The one thing he truly felt was fear. It was the fear of going back in there. Last night, exhausted, he went to bed and thought he would be unable to sleep. In fact, he fell asleep almost at once and had a dream. It was dusk. He was on a bus going up First Avenue. This was odd because he had not taken a bus in New York for at least 10 years. Before he knew it, the bus was up around 110th Street, and it was dark. He had missed his stop, although he couldn't remember what his stop was supposed to be. He was now in a black neighborhood. In fact, it should have been a Latin neighborhood, namely Spanish Harlem, but it was a black neighborhood. He got off the bus, fearing that if he stayed on, things would only get worse. In doorways, on stoops, on the sidewalks, he could see figures in the gloom, but they hadn't seen him yet. He hurried along the streets in the shadows, trying to make his way west. good sense would have told him to head straight back down First Avenue, but it seemed terribly important to head west. Now he realized the figures were circling. They said nothing. They didn't even come terribly close, for the time being. They had all the time in the world. He hurried through the darkness, seeking out the shadows, and gradually the figures closed in. Gradually, for they had all the time in the world. He woke up in a dreadful panic, perspiring, his heart leaping out of his chest. He had been asleep for less than 2 hours. Early in the morning, as the sun came up, he felt stronger. The humming and burning had ceased, and he began to wonder, "Am I free of this dreadful condition?" Of course, he hadn't understood. The vast circuit was merely down for the night. The millions of accusing eyes were closed. In any event, he decided, "I will be strong." What other choice did he have? He had none, other than to die again, slowly or quickly, and truly. It was in that frame of mind that he decided he would not be a prisoner in his own apartment. He would lead his life as best he could and set his jaw against the mob. He would start by taking Campbell to the bus stop, as always. At 7 o'clock, Tony, the doorman, called upstairs with apologies to say that about a half dozen reporters and photographers were camped outside on the sidewalk and in cars. Bonita relayed the message, and Sherman squared his jaw and raised his chin and resolved to deal with them the same way you would deal with foul weather. The two of them, Sherman, in his most uncompromising nail-head worsted suit from England, and Campbell in her Tolliver school uniform, got off the elevator and approached the door, and Tony said with genuine feeling, "Good luck. They're a rude lot." Out on the sidewalk, the first one was a very young man, babyish in appearance, and he approached with something resembling politeness and said, "Mr. McCoy, I'd like to ask you—" Sherman took Campbell's hand and raised his Yale chin and said, "I have no comment whatsoever. Now, if you'll just excuse me—" Suddenly, 5, 6, 7 of them were all around him and around Campbell, and there was no more Mr. McCoy. "Sherman, 1 minute. Who was the woman? Sherman, hold it a second. Just one picture. Hey, Sherman, your lawyer says—" "Hold it. Hey, hey!" "What's your name, pretty?" One of them was calling Campbell pretty. Appalled and furious, he turned toward the voice, the same one, with the tangles of kinky hair pasted on his skull, and now 2 pieces of toilet paper on his cheek. Sherman turned back to Campbell. A confused smile was on her face. The cameras. Picture-taking had always meant a happy occasion. "What's her name, Sherman?" "Hi, pretty. What's your name?" The filthy one with the toilet paper on his face was bending over his little girl and speaking in an unctuous, avuncular voice.
"Leave her alone," said Sherman.
He could see the fear come into Campbell's face with the sharpness of his own voice. All at once, a microphone was in front of his nose, blocking his vision. A tall, sinewy young woman with big jaws. "Henry Lamb lies near death in the hospital, and you're walking down Park Avenue. How do you feel about Henry?" Sherman swung his forearm up to knock the microphone out of his face. The woman began screaming, "You big bastard!" to her colleagues. "You saw that! He hit me! The son of a bitch hit me! You saw that! You saw it! I'm having you arrested for assault, you son of a bitch!" The pack swarmed about them, Sherman and his little girl. He reached down and put his arm around Campbell's shoulders and tried to pull her close to him and walk quickly toward the corner at the same time.
"Come on, Sherman, just a couple of questions and we'll let you go."
From behind, the woman was still bellowing and whining.
"Hey, you get a picture of that? I want to see what you got. That's evidence. You got to show it to me."
Then down the street,
"You don't care who you hit, do you, you racist fuck?"
Racist fuck? The woman was white. Campbell's face was frozen in fear and consternation. The light changed, and the pack followed the two of them and pigged and hived about them all the way across Park Avenue. Sherman and Campbell, hand in hand, plowed on straight ahead, and the reporters and photographers who surrounded them scampered backward and sideways and crabwise.
"Sherman! Sherman!
Look at me, pretty."
The parents, nannies, and children waiting at the Tolliver bus stop shrank back. They wanted no part of the disgusting eruption they saw coming toward them, this noisy swarm of shame, guilt, humiliation, and torment. On the other hand, they also didn't want their little ones to miss the bus, which was approaching. So they shuddered and retreated a few feet into a clump, as if blown together by the wind. For a moment, Sherman thought someone might step in to help, not so much for his sake as for Campbell's. But he was mistaken. Some stared, as if they didn't know who he was. Others averted their eyes. Sherman scanned their faces. The lovely little Mrs. Luger. She had both hands on the shoulders of her little girl, who stared with big, fascinated eyes. Mrs. Luger looked at him as if he were a vagrant from the 67th Street Armory. Campbell, in her little burgundy uniform, trudged up the steps into the interior of the bus, and then cast one last look over her shoulders. Tears streamed down her face without a sound. Now a pang tore through Sherman's solar plexus. He had not yet died again. He was not yet dead for a second time. Not yet. The photographer, with the toilet paper on his cheek, was right behind him, not 18 inches away, with his horrible instrument screwed into his eye socket. Grab him. Drive it into his brain. "Hey, pretty, you dare say to my flesh and blood." But what was the use? For they weren't the enemy out there any longer, were they? They were parasites inside his very hide. The humming and the burning began again for the day. Fallow sauntered across the city room and let them drink in his imposing figure. He held in his midsection and straightened his back. Tomorrow, he would begin a serious exercise regimen. There was no reason why he shouldn't have a heroic physique. On the way downtown, he had stopped off at Hertzfeld, a haberdashery on Madison Avenue that carried European and British clothes, and he had bought a spotted navy silk grenadine necktie. The tiny spots were embroidered in white. He had put it on right there in the store, letting the salesman get a load of his detachable collar. He was wearing his best shirt, which was from Bowring Arundel & Company, Savile Row. It was a sincere shirt, and it was a sincere necktie. If only he could afford a new blazer, with rich belly-cut lapels that didn't shine. Ah, well, hey-ho, soon enough. He stopped by the edge of the desk and picked up a city light from a stack of early editions left there for the use of the staff. Seek Foxy Brunette Mystery Girl. Another page one story by Peter Fallow. The rest of the print swam amid the foggy eye trash in front of his face, but he continued to stare at it, so as to give them all a chance to drink in the presence of Peter Fallow. Take a look, you poor drudges, humped over your word processors, clattering away and nattering away and grousing about your 100 big ones. All at once he felt so grand, he thought about what a superior gesture it would be to walk over to poor Goldman and give him his $100. Well, he'd put that in the back of his mind. When he reached his cubicle, there were already 6 or 7 message slips on his desk. He leafed through them, half expecting that one might be from a movie producer. Sir Gerald Steiner, formerly the Dead Mouse, was heading his way with his coat off and a pair of bright red felt suspenders over his striped shirt and a smile on his face, a charming smile, an ingratiating smile, instead of that malevolent wolf-eyed look of a few weeks back. The canteen of vodka was still hidden in the pocket of the raincoat, which still hung on the plastic coat rack in the corner. He could probably take it out and knock back a fiery jolt right in front of the mouse, and what would come of it? Nothing but a knowing, would-be, comradely mouse smile, if he knew his mouse. "Peter," said Steiner. "Peter. No more school proctors, Fallow. Want to see something to brighten your day?" Steiner slapped the photograph down on Fallow's desk. It showed Sherman McCoy with a terrific scowl on his face, giving a backhand swat to the face of a tall woman who was holding some sort of wand, which on close inspection turned out to be a microphone. With his other hand, he clutched the hand of a little girl in a school uniform. The little girl looked into the camera in a quizzical daze. In the background was the marquee of an apartment house and a doorman. Steiner was chuckling.
"The woman, dreadful woman, by the way, from some radio station, rings up 5 times an hour, says she's going to have McCoy arrested for assault. She wants the picture. She'll have the picture, all right. It's on page 1 of the next edition."
Fallow picked up the picture and studied it.
Pretty little girl. Must be difficult having a father who keeps hitting minorities, black boys, women. Have you ever noticed the way the Yanks refer to women as a minority?"
"The poor mother tongue," said Steiner.
"Marvelous picture," said Fallow, quite sincerely. "Who took it?"
"Silverstein. That chap does have sand. He does indeed."
"Silverstein's on the death watch?" asked Fallow.
"Oh, yes," said Steiner. "He loves that sort of thing. You know, Peter—"
"Peter?"
"I have respect, perhaps an inverted respect, but a true respect for chaps like Silverstein. They're the farmers of journalism. They love the good rich soil itself, for itself, not for the pay. They like to plunge their hands into the dirt."
Steiner paused, puzzled. He was always nonplussed by his own plays on words.
Oh, how Sir Gerald, baby boy of old Steiner, would love to be able to wallow in that filth with such Dionysian abandon, like a chap with sand. His eyes brimmed with a warm emotion. Love, perhaps, or nostalgia for the mud.
"The laughing vandals,"
said Steiner, smiling broadly and shaking his head apropos of the renowned exploits of the sandy photographer. That, in turn, led him to a broader source of satisfaction. "I want to tell you something, Peter. I don't know whether you fully appreciate it or not, but you've broken a very important story with this Lamb and McCoy business. Oh, it's sensational, but it's much more than that. It's a morality play. Think of that for a moment, a morality play. You mentioned minorities. I realize you were joking. But we are already hearing from these minorities, from these black organizations and whatnot. The very organizations that have been spreading rumors that we are racist and all the usual sort of rubbish, and now they're congratulating us and looking to us as a sort of beacon. That's quite a turnabout in a short time. These Third World Anti-Defamation League people, the very people who were so incensed over the laughing vandals, they've just sent me the most glowing testimonial. We're the bloody standard-bearers of liberalism and civil rights now. They think you're a genius, by the way. This man, Reverend Bacon, as they call him, seems to run it. He'd give you the Nobel Prize if it was up to him. I should have Brian show you the letter." Fallow said nothing. The idiots might be a bit more subtle about it.
"What I'm trying to get across, Peter, is that this is a very significant step in the progress of the newspaper. Our readers don't care about respectability one way or the other, but the advertisers do. I've already set Brian to work on seeing if perhaps we can't get some of these black groups to render their new opinion of the City Light formal in some fashion. Through citations or awards or, I don't know. But Brian will know how to go about it. I hope you'll be able to take time out to take part in whatever he comes up with. But we'll see how that works out." "Oh, absolutely," said Fallow. "Of course. I know how strongly these people feel. Did you know that the judge who refused to increase McCoy's bond yesterday has received death threats?"
"Death threats? You're not serious." The mouse twitched with the horrible excitement of it.
"It's true, and he's taking it quite seriously, too."
"Great God," said Steiner. "This is an amazing country." Fallow perceived this as a fortunate moment in which to suggest to Sir Gerald a significant step of another sort, a $1,000 advance, which in turn might suggest to the eminent mouse a rise in pay as well. And he was correct on both counts. As soon as the new blazer was ready, he was going to burn this one with pleasure. Scarcely a minute after Steiner had left, Fallow's telephone rang. It was Albert Vogel.
"Hey, Pete, how are you? Things are poppin', things are poppin', things are poppin'. Pete, you gotta do me a favor. You gotta give me McCoy's telephone number. It's unlisted."
Without knowing precisely why, Fallow found this a startling notion.
"Why would you want his telephone number, Al?"
"Well, the thing is, Pete, I've been retained by Annie Lamb, who wants to file a civil suit in behalf of her son. Two suits, actually, one against the hospital for gross negligence and one against McCoy."
"And you want his home telephone number? What for?"
"What for? We might have to negotiate."
"I don't see why you don't call his barrister."
"Jesus Christ, Pete!" Vogel's voice turned angry. "I didn't call you up for legal advice. All I want's a fucking telephone number. You got his number or not?"
Fallow's better judgment told him to say no, but his vanity wouldn't allow him to tell Vogel that I, Fallow, proprietor of the McCoy case, had been unable to procure the McCoy telephone number.
"All right, Al. I propose a barter. You give me the particulars of the civil suits and a one-day head start with the story, and I'll give you the telephone number."
"Look, Pete, I want to call a press conference about the suits. All I'm asking you for is a lousy telephone number."
"You can still call a press conference. You'll get a larger audience after I write the story." A pause.
"Okay, Pete," Vogel chuckled, but not very heartily. "I think I created a monster when I put you on to Henry Lamb. Who do you think you are, Lincoln Steffens?"
"Lincoln who?"
"Never mind. It wouldn't interest you. Okay, you can have the fucking story. Aren't you getting tired of all these exclusives? So give me the number." And so he did.
When one got right down to it, what difference would it make whether he had the number or not?
Chapter 24 The Informants. The dreadful orange carpet blazed away. Right next to the formica couch he was slouched upon, it had come loose from the floor, where it abutted the wall, and the crinkly metallic fibers frayed out. Sherman stared at the itchy sleaze of it as a way of averting his eyes from the sinister figures on the couch opposite him. He was afraid they would be staring at him, and would know who he was. The fact that Killian would make him wait like this sealed it, nailed down the correctness of what he was about to do. This would be his last visit to this place, his last descent into the vulgarity of favor banks, contracts, lower-crust fops, and cheap gutter philosophies. But soon curiosity got the better of him, and he looked at their feet. Two men. One had on a dainty little pair of slip-on shoes with decorative gold chains running across the top. The other wore a pair of snow-white Reebok sneakers. The shoes shuffled a bit as the two men's tails slid down the couch and they pushed themselves back up with their legs, and then slid down again and pushed back and slid down and pushed back. Sherman slid down and pushed back. They slid down and pushed back. Sherman slid down and pushed back. Everything about the place, even the obscene downslope of the couches, proclaimed tastelessness, shiftlessness, vulgarity, and at bottom, sheer ignorance. The two men were talking in what Sherman took to be Spanish.
"Hoy el mimo," one of them kept saying. "Hoy el mimo."
He let his eyes creep up as far as their midsections. Both had on knit shirts and leather jackets. More leather people.
"Hoy el mimo."
He took the big chance. Their faces. Immediately, he cast his eyes down again. They were staring right at him. Such cruel looks.
Both appeared to be in their early 30s. They had thick black hair coiffed and trimmed just so in vulgar but probably expensive hairdos. Both had their hair parted down the center and teased in such a way that the hair seemed to be gushing up in neat black ceremonial fountains. Such twisted expressions as they stared at him. Did they know? Now he could hear Killian's voice. Talk. Lore. All right. He consoled himself with the thought that he wouldn't have to listen to it much longer. The lion was right. How could he have entrusted his fate to anyone immersed in this sordid milieu? Killian appeared at the doorway from the inner hall. He had his arm around the shoulders of a pudgy and thoroughly dejected little